On Arena. Emma and the Assistant are the new movies up for review, and Christos Tsiolkas, author of The Slap, on his new novel, Damascus. One is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Well, it is Thursday night, and as ever, it's movie night here on Arena. We have two interesting new releases to bring to you. The Assistant from Australian filmmaker Kitty Green, and Emma, a bombastic dance soap opera from Chilean director Pablo Larraín. And since the Maybank holiday approaches, our very own version of Labour Day, we've asked our reviewers, Tara Brady and Daryl Jones, to tell us about their favourite films set in the workplace. But let's start with The Assistant from Kitty Green. And Tara, this takes place, takes as its basis rather, interviews that Green did with women who had worked in lots of different workplaces, but it did include women who had worked with the Weinstein Company. How big a part does that story play in this film?
Well, it's a really interesting thing because we never actually see the big bad boss on screen, but all the way through, he casts this huge shadow across the film, and there's certainly no question. I mean, a lot of American reviewers have called it the first post-Me Too film or the first post-Weinstein film, and there's definitely no question that the character that's there in the movie is a kind of Harvey Weinstein or Sats. It's definitely a sort of fake version of him. Her process was really interesting. I don't know if you saw her previous feature, which is a documentary feature casting Jean Benet, which is on Netflix, and it was a very kind of thorough, scholarly kind of a documentary that interviewed the residents of Boulder, Colorado, to talk about their relationship with the murder and the big news story when it broke in the 90s, and this is similarly painstaking. She interviewed over 100 women in all kinds of sectors, and it's one thing that she's been very, very careful to emphasize in when she's doing interviews is that it's not enough to kind of think about this as the Harvey Weinstein film, because this issue affects all sectors, and the people who are in the kind of lowest paid jobs in an office really do have rather a bad time of it, as the main character here, Jane, played by Julia Garner, certainly does.
And Jane is the named character, but for the most part, we've people referred to simply as, in the case of Jane, she's also referred to as the assistant of the film's title. We have other assistants and we have the HR manager, but names for the most part avoided. Is there a plot within all of that, Daryl?
Yeah, there is. I mean, it's a day in the life of a young female PA to a powerful film producer. I mean, a thinly disguised Harvey Weinstein, as has been said. And yes, everyone is unnamed during the course of the film, though the assistant is named as Jane in the credits. People do have names in the credits, but I think it's part of the point of it that everyone is anonymous. This is the kind of workplace where nobody wants to know anybody's name. She arrives very early, before dawn. She gets up, she prepares the day for her boss, she tidies his office, she plans his diary, she books his flights and his hotels, and when she's tidying the office, she picks up an earring and cleans a stain from the couch, and it becomes clear from this that the film producer sexually exploits young women. And when a particularly young looking girl arrives in the office, she tells us from Boise, Idaho, so right the way over the other side of the US, with the promise of a job, and she's put up in a hotel, the assistant takes it on herself to take her concerns to HR. So that's the setup, that's the premise of the film.
Let's listen to the clip actually where that young girl arrives. It's a scene from the movie Jane, played by Julia Garner. Her two male assistant counterparts here, played by Noah Robbins and Joss Orsini, and they hear about this potential new colleague.
Hi.
The new assistant's here.
What address do you have?
Okay, hang on.
Right. I'm not sure what happened there.
Sorry, who?
Okay, let me check on that. I'll get back
a
to
girl.
You.
She says she starts today.
Hey. There's a girl waiting at reception. She says that she's supposed to start here today.
Working here? With us? Where's she from?
Where's she from?
Idaho.
Idaho? Is that the one you met in Sun Valley? Oh, her. She's been here before. A few times. Send her in.
And there you heard Julia Garner there, and Nora Robbins, John Orsini in a clip from The Assistant. And there's one line in there that really makes my skin crawl. Is that the one he met in Sun Valley? One of the male assistants says, Tara. Mm-hmm. Is the viewing as uncomfortable as that clip made me feel in the space of whatever, 45 or 50 seconds?
It's incredibly uncomfortable. And it's actually worse than that. I think there's a moment where you realise she's considering going to put her hands up, and she's considering going to HR. And you suddenly find yourself going, don't do it. Because you know that that no good is going to come of it for her or for anyone else, because the culture is so awful. And it's not just Matthew McFadden's HR guy who you meet. It's like their colleagues are all so very casual about it. It's like, don't worry, you're not his type, someone says to her. And someone else, when there's a girl disappears in behind closed doors, another colleague says, oh, she's getting more out of it than he is. So that's one of the really clever things about keeping the actual character off the screen, because the boss, you hear him on the phone, you hear him growling, you hear him bellowing, and very often it's kind of indecipherable or inaudible. So that allows you to concentrate all the time on her story and the very kind of toxic culture that exists around her. And it really is like quite almost like a horror movie at times. It really is very, very gripping to watch.
In fact, you've, I think, found one of the scenes with Matthew McFadden's HR manager, you found that particularly horrifying, Dara.
Yeah, for me, it's the centerpiece of the film, and I thought I completely agree. I thought it made for really awful viewing. It's one of the most upsetting pieces of film I've seen in ages. It made me furious as well. I should say. So she goes to HR, and Matthew McFadden, who appears at the beginning to be kind of concerned and solicitous, but it soon turns into what should be a supportive meeting turns into a kind of nightmare. He subjects her to a barrage of questions which are hostile and dismissive and just this side of belligerent. And, this obviously is meant to and does very clearly capture a central truth of the Me Too movement, which is that workplace sexual harassment, workplace bullying are based on cultures of complicity and of silence, and also of encoded speech in which everyone knows what's going on, but no one will articulate it openly, so that allegations become impossible to prove in any kind of legalistic way, although everyone knows the truth. And this, the film says, is how powerful men get away with it. And Matthew McFadden says to her at one point, do you want to keep working here? And he makes a very thinly veiled threat, tells her there are 400 people ready to walk into her job, so she should consider herself lucky to have it.
Stars from you, Daryl.
4.5.
4.5 from Daryl. And Tara, overall, was it as effective a film for you as it seems to have been for Daryl, and Stars?
Oh, definitely. I definitely go 4.5 as well. It's a very, very powerful film. An important film.
Very powerful. And an important film, you're saying there as well. Okay, that's The Assistant, directed by Kitty Green. Let's move on then to Emma, directed by Pablo Larraín, Chilean director. Tara, Mariana Di Girolamo is a young dancer whose attempt to adopt a son has ended in disaster, and her marriage to her choreographer partner, Gaston, played by Gael García Bernal, is on the rocks. What's her reaction to all of that? Dance is so important in her reaction to everything, but what's her reaction to her difficulties in her marriage?
Well, this is just such a big, wild movie, and I think the best way of describing it is that it's a sort of a cross between a dance movie and a big, sexy telenovela, and it's all kind of told in really big movements. And what she's grieving for her son, and she goes out looking for what in kind of classic Hollywood terms would be looking for things in all the wrong places. She starts setting fires. She gets involved to the great horror of her husband. She gets involved in reggaeton, which in the kind of strange world of this movie seems to be somehow synonymous with lesbianism. She has multiple sexual partners, and she's really out, like, doing such kind of wild things that you keep wondering, you kind of wonder to yourself, am I supposed to take this figuratively or am I supposed to take this literally? Like, is she really actually going around and setting fire to traffic lights in the middle of the city as a kind of piece of performance art? And she is. It's just that kind of outlandish big character. And slowly we kind of piece together what's going on with her and the husband, and that in itself is quite the soap opera. And they've returned the 7-year-old boy that they adopted back to the orphanage after he tried to burn down the house. He also set his aunt's face on fire, and he shut the cat in the freezer, but she's still desperate to get him back, and she cooks up a plan, and the plan is even more melodramatic than all the things I've just said.
Yeah, and in some ways that sounds as if there's so much plot we can't continue to describe it, but I'm guessing that perhaps the plot isn't actually the important thing here in some ways, Daryl, because I watched some of this today and all I kept thinking and looking at were these beautiful set dance pieces that kind of interspersed between the scenes, almost interrupting the action of the movie with this beautiful choreography to watch.
Yeah, that's right. So even the brief summary we've just got from Tara, the plot is clearly preposterous. It makes no sense and doesn't bear any scrutiny at all. But the film isn't interested in plot, nor really, I have to say, in spite of, you know, being named after the titular heroine, it's not really interested in character either, I don't think. You know, it's interested in look, it's interested in movement. It's an ultra-stylish, choreographed film. So Emma is a dancer. She teaches dance to primary school children, and she tells the school principal that she's interested in movement, in freedom, in expression. I hate to have to say this, but this is a film which makes much use of the medium of interpretive dance, and if the film has a mode, it is symbolic. You know, there are these recurring images, these recurring symbolic images, flames very importantly, fairground rides, traffic lights. The film's first images, as we've heard, is of a burning traffic light, and Emma is herself, it turns out, a pyromaniac, and who gets her hands on a flamethrower and has an affair with a fireman, and the dance troupe perform a routine and in front of an enormous blazing sun. And the film is fascinated by colours. And in a way, this was my favourite thing about the film. I thought I spent the film enjoying its use of colours, tracking Emma's different coloured tracksuits that she wears. She wears a powder blue one, she wears a bright red one, she wears a claret one. People live in lime green apartment blocks, you know. There are vivid traffic lights. The film is washed in colours of red and blue light at various points. And Emma herself has this wonderful peroxide blonde hair. So I think that's the centre of gravity. That's the focus of the film.
Where would it fit in then to Pablo Larraín's work, Tara? I suppose one of Chile's most acclaimed directors, undoubtedly, and his films are not for the faint-hearted. So
no.
Emma sounds as if it is in that category. Does it fit in with his other work?
No, it actually really doesn't. It's only the second film that he's done with that's kind of female oriented. The previous one being Jackie with Natalie Portman as Jackie Kennedy. But there's sort of two kind of films he makes. One is a film like Jackie, which is just this kind of experience that you just kind of let wash over you, and it's kind of color and it's sound and it's score. And that's very much what Emma is. But there's a second kind of film he makes, which is more typical of him, you know, which are these kind of like, they're like these kind of really filthy, provocative pictures. So you have like, and they're very, very engaged with Chilean politics and with the recent Chilean path. So, you have Tony Manero, one of his early breakout films, who's like this excrement-fearing, smearing John Travolta impersonator. You've got The Club, which was about this house of pedophile priests. And they're really, really talky films. They're filled with talk. But you get that a little bit in Emma. You do get these kind of outbursts that are just like these verbal barrages, particularly from Gael Garcia Bernal. I mean, it's really interesting. This is the third film that Gael Garcia Bernal has made with Pablo Larraín, and they're all very different. If you remember, that he's very, very mysterious and enigmatic in No, the film that they made about 5 years ago about the Chilean plebiscite, about whether or not Pinochet would stay in power for another 7 years. And then the second film they made together was Neruda, and Bernal played the police officer, fictionalized version of the police officer who constantly chased the poet and politician. But this one, he has to take kind of a back seat because it is like the character of Emma sort of swallows up the whole movie, and you really just, as Daryl said, it's kind of one of these experience things. You really just have to go with it, and it's a very commendable character in a way because we keep anyone who's written a screenplay or a novel, they'll at some point have a conversation with someone about the character being relatable or likable, and Emma doesn't. Neither the character nor the film care about those things, and that's really right. Quite compelling.
Stars from you, Tara?
I go 5.
5 from Tara. Were you as impressed, Daryl?
No, I'm afraid I wasn't. You really have to go with it, Tarzan. I wasn't going with it. At various points in the film, authority figures, child protection officers and school principals tell Emma what an awful person she is and how she's not fit to be near children. And I felt I was going against the grain of the film, but I was completely in agreement with them. It seems to be a film that the lesson of which is, and of Emma herself, is that you can get away with anything as long as you're really, really good looking. And I wasn't having it. 2 stars.
2 from you. Difference of opinion there on Emma, which is available on Mubi, by the way. It's free all day tomorrow in 50 days around the world, including Ireland, 50 countries around the world, including Ireland. And The Assistant is on various platforms, including Curzon, Apple and iTunes. So we also asked you to have a bit of nostalgia for us this evening and to look back at a film set in the workplace, to choose one that particularly was important to you. Tara, 9 to 5, 1980 comedy featuring Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin and Dolly Parton. Why?
I think it's the perfect May Day film. I think it's the most fun that organized labor can be. It's a very, very fun sort of feminist revenge comedy, and you get those terrific fantasy sequences in which they punish their boss, who's played by Dabney Coleman, who's absolutely brilliant sort of mustache twirling villain. And you get to see Dolly Parton lasso him and roast him on a spit and that sort of thing. The film, unsurprisingly, was Jane Fonda's idea, which is because around the height of her political activism, I suppose, and it's held up very well because the sexual politics of the film are still hot. Dolly is repeatedly sexually harassed in all sorts of like small and big ways in the office. When Lily Tomlin complains that a man that she trained in was promoted ahead of her, she's told, "Oh, spare me the women's lib crap." And you see the same sexist work environment that you see in a film like The Apartment, which was made a whole 2 decades earlier. There's this really fun kind of bungled kidnapping plot, and as I'm sure you know, they then fake the boss's signature, and they implement job sharing and on-site crash and addiction counseling program and an office redesign that accommodates wheelchair users and then equal pay, and those are things that most workers are still fighting for. And if anything, I think the contemporary viewer is probably going to marvel at the luxury of getting home after 9 to 5. I think that's become an alien concept. And then, of course, you have that terrific theme song, which nobody in the world could argue with at all.
Absolutely. Well, listen, let's listen to a clip from 9 to 5. Lily Tomlin playing Violet. And that's one of the scenes you spoke about. In fact, she's venting her anger at being passed over for promotion. She's venting that anger at her boss, played by Dabney Coleman.
What? Now, let me finish, OK? And don't go flying off the handle.
You gave that promotion to Bob Enright instead of me? I've got 5 years seniority over him.
I know that.
For Christ's sake, I trained him.
I know that, but see, the company...
Oh, the company bullshit. It's your decision. You promoted him. You tell me why.
Well, in the first place, see, Bob does have a college degree.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. While he's away at college getting his precious, useless degree, I'm working my butt off at this company.
And in the second place, he does have a family to support.
And I don't? What has that got to do with anything?
Violet, look, my hands are tied here. The company needs a man in this position. Clients would rather deal with men when it comes to figures.
Oh, now we're getting at it. I lose a promotion because of some idiot prejudice. The boys in the club are threatened, and you're so intimidated by any woman that won't sit at the back of the bus.
Spare me the women's lib crap, okay? Now, I know how you feel, and I understand it.
You understand zilch.
I understand I'm still a boss here. And even though you might be pretty valuable out there, you better get a hold of yourself. I'm not going to sit here and take this. God damn it. Dorley, get in here!
Okay, Dabney Coleman there and Lily Tomlin in a scene from 9 to 5 and that the choice of Tara Brady. We asked Tara and Daryl, our movie reviewers this evening, to choose films connected with the workplace. Your choice, not in a very different world in lots of ways. Working Girl, Daryl, was your choice. Again, a 1980s film. Why this?
Why this? Yeah, a very similar. We're in a very similar world. You're right. I've always loved this film. I first saw this film in 1989 in the American Cultural Institute in Łódź in Poland. It was being screened as part of a series of Oscar-winning films, and I was teaching at the university there. And this was just a few weeks before the Berlin Wall came down. And the film seemed to me then to be prophetic. It seemed to be a harbinger of a new kind of freedom. And I wanted to see what it looked like now, all these years later, in the wake of the financial crash, in the wake of the Me Too movement, in the wake of our current lockdown. What kind of film would I be watching? And I have to say, it didn't disappoint. It's dated in some ways, but it's still a marvellous, marvellous film. And it has, at the very beginning, some of the greatest opening credits in cinema history. And the film is worth watching just for its opening scene, beginning with a famous close-up of the Statue of Liberty, pans out to an aerial shot of southern Manhattan, of the financial district of Wall Street. There's the Twin Towers, and then it zooms into the Staten Island Ferry, which is carrying Tess McGill, Melanie Griffith, and hundreds of other working girls and boys on their daily commute over to Manhattan. And all of this takes place to the sounds of Carly Simon's Let the River Run, an actual anthem, and it's enormously powerful. And in its way, it's a very moving scene. You know, the song's most famous line is, "Come the New Jerusalem." And, you know, I'm not generally in the habit of getting sort of misty-eyed over neoliberal capitalism, but this scene gets me every time. It's a very powerful scene. And the rest of the film, we have a magnificent cast. Melanie Griffith, Sigourney Weaver, Harrison Ford, Joan Cusack, Alec Baldwin, all firing on all cylinders. This is Melanie Griffith's best performance, and I think we tend to forget just how great she really was. Sigourney Weaver is always great, of course, and here she's perfect. Harrison Ford is actually showing he's a rather good comic actor. And Joan Cusack steals every scene she's in as Tess's colleague, Cynthia. She has the film's best line to Harrison Ford. She says, "Can I get you anything? Coffee, tea, me?" And you know, the film is full of these wonderful lines. But it's also really good on the signifiers of class and gender in the workplace. You know, first of all, there are the hairstyles. So this is the very late 1980s, and things were getting out of all proportion, and hair was getting out of all proportion. And Tess and Cynthia and their colleagues on the office floor have what must be the biggest hair ever committed to celluloid. And I think if you don't fall in love with Joan Cusack's enormous hairdo and radioactive eye makeup, then you're lost. You have no soul. You know, there are amazing clothes. You know, the look of the film and the relationship between look and class and status is all there. And when Melanie Griffith, when Tess borrows one of Catherine's dresses, Cynthia, and discovers that it costs $6,000, Cynthia screams, "It's not even leather." You know, and this is, it should be said, this is a fairy tale. This is a kind of Cinderella story, and only in a fairy tale could Melanie Griffith ever actually fit into one of Sigourney Weaver's dresses. But this is the film that we're in. But it's also it's dated, but it's dated in some interesting ways which have nothing to do with hair or shoulder pads. Its gender politics turn out to be quite a little bit dodgy with hindsight. You know, Melanie Griffith, the film can't help but leer at Melanie Griffith and never passes up an opportunity to have her parade in her underwear. Harrison Ford is, sad to say, rather sleazy, at least when we first meet him, trying to pick Tess up in a bar with dodgy chatter blinds, and he gets her drunk. And also, it turns out that the problem is not men in the workplace. So it's not like 9 to 5 in that way. It's not like the assistant. And the problem is bad women. The problem is Catherine. There's only room for one woman around the boardroom table, alas.
All right. So it doesn't sit that well in some ways, or sits very differently alongside the assistant. If I can just come to you with a final question, Tara Brady. 9 to 5 sits differently alongside the assistant, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, it certainly does. There's not much. I mean, The Assistant is a great film, but there's not much fun to be had, and there certainly aren't any dolly lassoing sequences in it. One thing I would say about the politics of the hair of Working Girl, I'm always very sorry to see the hair disappear in Working Girl, because one, yeah. You know, it's the big hair is sort of codified as being sort of trashy, and I think that's very unfair, because that hair took a lot of work. I mean, they must have hung upside down and backcombed with a gallon of hairspray for like at least 20 minutes to get that hair. So I think it's an undervalued asset.
Yeah,
okay, Working
agree.
Girl and 9 to 5, the two choices of Tara Brady and Daryl Jones. I think you're going to agree with the undervalued asset of the hair there, Daryl, but we need to go.
Absolutely,
let me remind
yeah,
you once
yeah.
again that the new releases that we spoke about, Emma, is available on Newbie. Free all day tomorrow, 50 countries around the world, including Ireland. The Assistant, the other new movie we spoke about, on various platforms, including Curzon, Apple and iTunes. Christos Tsiolkos is the award-winning author of novels including Barracuda, Loaded, Dead Europe and the global bestseller The Slap, which was long-listed for the Man Booker Prize and adapted into a TV miniseries. The action of his latest novel, Damascus, takes place in a brutal Roman world, starting 35 years after the death of Christ. The story focuses on Saul of Tarsus, who, after his legendary conversion on the road to Damascus, becomes Paul, apostle to the Gentiles and founder of churches across Greece and Rome. It's Paul who turns what was a Jewish messianic cult into a universal creed that would define for many Western civilization. And Christos Tsiolkos joins me from London this evening. What brought you to Saul or to Paul? I think it's been a long time. Possibly obsession is the right word to use in this case, Christos, is it?
Obsession may be the right word. I have also called it a wrestling with Paul. I grew up in the Greek Orthodox faith, so in the Eastern tradition, where Paul wasn't, you know, Paul as a young kid was a very stern face on icons in the churches that I would attend with mum and dad. But where I really first encountered Paul was I'd moved from an inner city school, very heavily migrant, to an outer suburban school where I felt, in year eight, I felt like I didn't belong there. And it was at a time that I was understanding that I was something called homosexual. I don't even know if I knew exactly what that word meant. And I became, for a period, an evangelical Christian, making a deal, if you like, with God, that if I could not be gay, if I could not be this thing, that I would, you know, dedicate my life to God. But I couldn't not reconcile that struggle. It was and Paul I encountered through the first letter to the Corinthians, where amongst a long, long list, he says that homosexuals are to be denied God's grace and God's love. And at 15, I abandoned faith, and it was a relief, to be honest, Sean.
So that was the straw that broke the camel's back, as it were.
Look, it was Corinthians. You know, it's just to in relationship to Paul, it was like I couldn't hear him because of that line, and because that line seemed to be so important to the interpretation of Paul that I was receiving in that church group. So I wouldn't say it was necessarily Paul himself that created that difficulty for me, but I really believe that you could not be gay and be with God, and that's where the relief came of kind of abandoning faith.
But you did come back to Paul, wasn't it? In your mid 20s, then you came back to him, and if I have my information is correct, you wept, in fact, as you started to rediscover Paul in a church.
That's right. I was in my late 20s. In a very different way. I was a young adult. I had what they were, in a way, is not important. I'd made some bad choices in my life that I was regretting. I'd also had betrayed someone I loved, which I felt very ashamed of. And so I remember it was lunch, it was a sunny day, and there across from work was a Uniting Church, a really small Uniting Church. And I still to this day don't know what it was that motivated me to go in there. And as soon as I entered the door, Sean, I just fell to prayer, you know, and I hadn't prayed for a long, long time. And I started howling. And even though I didn't believe in God. I was asking for help. And I think that's that kind of solace that is in prayer that I had forgotten about for a long time. And there had been, there in that church on one of the pews was a copy of the New Testament. And I picked it up. And again, it had been a long time since I'd read the Gospels or all Paul's letters. And I started by reading the Gospel of Matthew because I'd always loved that, of the Gospel text. And then I started reading the Paul of Romans, which is the first letter in the canonical Bible. And instead of finding someone who was saying you're going to be excluded from God, I actually found someone who was speaking about the misery, and I'll use that word, that I was feeling. And he gave me solace. Now, it was many, many, many years after that I started working on Damascus, but I think it's actually in that reconciliation between the first Paul that I couldn't listen to and that Paul who gave me strength that the roots or germ of this idea came from. And also, I mean, I had made a deliberate choice, I think, in choosing Matthew, the Gospel of there, because it has the Sermon on the Mount. It has actually has so much of what for me is, even as a non-Christian now, what is remarkable in the Christian gospel. And that's what I wanted to do, to explore who was this man, what was his struggle, and also what does Christianity mean for me now, and what does it mean for us in the world.
So who are you then, 3 decades later? So that's a seed that's been germinating for a long time. Three decades later, you come to give us your version or your look at Paul in the novel Damascus. And we see him both from his own point of view, a number of narrations over maybe a 20-year period or something in that region. And in between those, we get narrations from various other characters, followers of his, both fictional and real. The man we first meet certainly is quite the tyrant. He's had a stoning, and a very violent stoning. How difficult was it to even get into that level of description and the violence involved in it?
One of the things I said to myself before I began Damascus was that because I knew it was quite ambitious, and I knew that I was dealing with history that is so important to people, still so important to people, that I wanted to be sure of what I was doing. And I gave myself a year where I was just researching. So I read between the 4th century BC, or before the Common Era, to the 3rd century AD, or the Common Era. And I had returned to the Bible. And I also discovered the Apocrypha, and I discovered texts that had been erased, if you like, from the history of Christianity. The other thing I discovered was that this was a slave society and we don't have the voices of the slave. You know, we have some beautiful writing that is in Latin and in Greek and in Hebrew, but very rarely do we have the slave speaking. And in fact, one of the few places where it does occur is in the Gospel message. And that was, in terms of the writer in me, that was an astonishing thing to discover. And I really, I wanted to convey to the reader, I mean, because I'm not a theologian, right? I'm a writer of fiction. I wanted to, from the moment that you open that book, I wanted you to understand what it would be like for an ordinary person who is a slave or very, very destitute in this world that is incredibly violent, that it has a right to do to your body whatever it wants to do. That is what the Roman state was. Oh, there's another, I keep wanting to pay homage to her. I've had 3 great teachers in my life, and the first one was in primary school, a woman called Ms. Luneman, who, when we were in about grade 4, and it was a very heavily migrant school, there was a girl whose parents were from Yugoslavia and they divorced. And this is the 70s, and it was still a shocking thing back then. It, you know, may surprise some listeners, but it was a shocking thing. And a couple of the boys, or a few of the boys, started calling her a slut, or calling her mother a slut. And this teacher grouped us together and told us the story of Jesus coming across the woman who's about to be stoned for adultery. And she made us feel what it was like to be that terrified young girl. Mm-hmm. And she made us understand what was powerful in Jesus saying, if you are without sin, then raise your stone. And she was asking us, even as little children, to make sense of that moral message. And we could make sense of it. And I think even though it was a, you know, it was, I was still a child. I think there was almost an awareness I had that sometime in the future I could be that, that girl in the circle, that something about the choices or the way my life could go meant that I could be shamed and be an outsider. I owe a really early moral education to this fantastic teacher. And that's why, I mean, the novel's gone through, you know, through seven drafts. I really struggled in how to tell this story, but that has never changed, that it began with a stoning, because that's, as I said, a homage to that moral lesson I learned as a little boy.
And in some ways, the Paul that you present to us is a kind of outsider in that he has terrible secrecy around his carnal desires. And you don't spare us any of the detail in terms of how he satisfies those carnal desires, not just in terms of homosexual relationships, but basically he really needs to fulfill that carnal need. What was the basis for that aspect of Paul's character?
Clearly that's the element. I've just been explaining, I guess, what has been the biggest struggle for me in terms of the Christian upbringing that I had, that I couldn't reconcile desire, that carnality. And I think I'm not a Christian, but I have a deep, I hope I'm communicating what a deep respect and love I have for what is radical and important in Jesus's teachings. I mean, I think that they're astounding, that notion that you owe the stranger an equal love to that you have for your parents, to that you have for your child, to that you have for your partner. That's radical in 2020, let alone what it would have sounded like 2,000 years ago. But my battle has been about the body, and I think one of the reasons I can't call myself Christian, why I still remain an outsider to that faith, is because of this belief embedded in many of the teachings that there is a pure spirit and a vile or profane body. And you know, I'm speaking to you, you're in Ireland, I don't have to tell you how damaging that history has been. So it seemed to me important that when I was creating Paul as a living human being, I'm not writing about the saints. Saints are perfect, so there's no drama in that. I'm actually, what made me able to walk with Paul rather than wrestle with Paul was thinking, what if he's going through similar struggles? How does he reconcile the message of the Gospels with what the body is? And that's how I felt I could begin the book and how I could begin his story.
And you use an interesting word in the midst of your answer there, the word stranger. And it's a word that appears several times throughout the book, always with a capital S, I'm pretty certain.
That's so right, yes.
That outsider, it includes Paul, I'm guessing, from what you've just said, but it also includes many of the followers that we hear from as well. That parallel to contemporary society must have been on your mind.
Of course. I mean, I think that, you know, one thing that concerns me about the contemporary world is that we're not very good. I can only speak from Australia where I am, but I suspect it's not different to your part of the world, Sean. I sometimes think we're terrible at history. And we're terrible at understanding where so many ideas come from, and I understand the anger and antipathy that so many people have for the church because of its history. And that's not only about sexual abuse, that's also about the history of colonial exploitation that the church was part of. I completely understand that. But I also think that there was something in that early teaching that has been profoundly important for the world. So I could only hear the Paul of the Corinthians 1, which was that, you know, you will not find God's love because you are homosexual. What I wish I had been taught by these who were good people in that church was the Paul of Galatians, who said, we are not master and we are not slave. We are not Greek and we are not Jew. We are not woman and we are not man. When we are one in Christ Jesus, we are one. That's an absolutely profound historic moment, the beginning of the notion of what you owe the universal human. And it's the other astonishing teaching that I think is in which is in the Gospels, and Paul is our interpreter of the Gospels, is precisely that of the stranger. The stranger is not an enemy. A stranger is not someone to be despised. A stranger is not someone to be turned away, but someone that you owe love and compassion to and care to. And still now, that is an astonishing concept, as I said. Mm. I was writing this book when Syria was being blown apart by a horrific civil war. Millions of people were fleeing their home. And my country in Australia has been really cruel to asylum seekers. But I think all across Europe that we've seen cruelty to asylum seekers. And so that aspect of the gospel is still profound for us, and we still haven't lived up to it. I hope that when you read the book, you are in the world 2,000 years ago, but I hope that you are also making connections between what is happening in the world now.
Christos Tsiolkos has been talking to me about his latest novel, Damascus, which is published by Atlantic Books. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. Today is Poetry Day Ireland. And to mark that, here is Yvan Boland reading at an event in the UN in 2018 to mark 100 years of women's suffrage.
This is called Our Future Will Become the Past of Other Women. Show me your hand. I see our past. Your Pam, roughened by heat, by frost, by pulling a crop out of the earth, by lifting a cauldron off the hearth, by stripping rushes dipped in fat to make a wick, make a rushlight. That was your world, your entry to our ancestry in our darkest century. Ghost sufferer, our ghost sister, remind us now again that history changes in one moment, with one mind, that it belongs to us, to all of us. And as we mark these 100 years, we will not leave you behind.
Yvan Boland there, who died earlier this week, reading her poem, Our Future Will Become the Past of Other Women. And she read that at the UN in 2018. TV writer, producer and producer Ryan Murphy has quite a track record with credits like Glee, Feud, The Assassination of Gianni Versace and The People vs. O.J. Simpson. Now he has turned his attention to his own industry in the new Netflix series Hollywood. Alan Carr has been looking at the new series and he joins me now. This is quite definitely a Hollywood story. There are real people in here. We'll hear from Rock Hudson, Anna May Wong is in there. But at its very heart, really, Alan, this is a group of people trying to make it in Tinseltown, a group of fictional characters.
Well, absolutely. And I think that has it in common with a lot of Murphy's previous work. It's about outsiders trying to triumph over adversity. So this is the new 7-part Netflix series, and it sees a group of very disparate characters, each of whom embody a different facet of Hollywood's golden age. And it kind of each character, I suppose, embodies the kind of unfair systems that were around in Hollywood then and indeed now, Sean. So there's kind of issues of race and gender and sexuality that still continue to this day. So it's about a bunch of young wannabes trying to overcome the old guards during the golden age of Hollywood, set just after the Second World War, while Hollywood was going through a real boom period. Now, things are about to change, and this young cast arrived just at the right time, I guess.
Well, let's listen to one of those wannabes, a newbie called Jack Costello, who's early on in the film, he's queuing outside the studio gate looking for a start with thousands of other hopefuls when Miss Roswell of the studio comes along.
OK, listen up. Rule number one, do not look at the camera. Rule number two, do not talk to the director. In fact, a good rule of thumb is to not talk at all. Rule number three, if you see a platter of food on the soundstage, do not eat it. That is not for you. That is for the actors and the crew. If you see food on the set, do not eat that. That is a prop. Now we have that out of the way. Today we're lensing a scene from a war pic where the plane goes down and a bunch of passengers flail around in the water and then die, okay? All right, I have you, and you, you. And you? You. You. And you. Okay, thank you very much. That's it for today. See y'all tomorrow.
Excuse me, Miss Roswell. I beg your pardon. Jack Costello. I think I'd be great in your war picture. The drowning scene? You see, I fought at Anzio.
Oh, you have training?
Well, sure, Fort Benning, Georgia.
I mean acting training. You got any of that?
Well, no.
Good-looking kid like you, you think you just gotta show up and poof, you're a movie star, huh? Well, that ain't how it works. Pretty face, but no training. Kid.
David Corenswet there playing Jack Costello in Hollywood, which is the new series from Ryan Murphy. Alan Carr has been looking at the series for us and he's speaking with me this evening. I mean, she refers to him there as a good looking kid, and he is a very good looking guy, David Corenswet. Do we get anything beneath the good looks, and not only in him, but to what extent in these characterizations that we get of the fictional characters, Alan, are we getting types rather than characters?
Well, Jack is indeed very good looking, Sean. He's a kind of a newly married Missouri farm boy who's just returned from the Second World War. He's struggling broke. His wife is about to have twins. So he's willing to do anything to make it in Hollywood. So, I mean, everybody in this is from central casting. I mean, they are all cliches, but we are talking about Hollywood after all. Jack, I suppose, you know, dominates the first three episodes of the series. It's seven parts long, but it's got a teeming cast. I mean, this is a teeming cast full of blonde bombshells. It's full of matinee idols and kind of fat movie moguls. So some of them are very kind of like, you know, basic studies, but others we get more in depth with. Jack is quite pivotal, but we also meet Jeremy Pope, who plays Archie Coleman, who's a young gay black man who is working on a script about Peg Entwistle, who was a young English actress who committed suicide by throwing herself off the H in Hollywood sign at the age of 24 back in 1932. And I think his character is a bit more fleshed out. There are other characters like Laura Harrier plays Camille Washington, who's a young black actress who's struggling to rebel against the being typecast in these Uncle Tom-like roles as kind of comic relief as maids. A lot like Butterfly McQueen, who played the maid Prissy in Gone with the Wind. I think that this character, Camille Washington, is probably based on Dorothy Dandridge, who was the first black woman to Oscar nominated for Carmen Jones back in 1954. So, you know, each character here is an archetype. They're an archetype. They are a cliche, but they're all there to serve a function, and that is to explore, and in Murphy's case as a writer, to rewrite. This is a very revisionistic history of the golden age of Hollywood, very much pitched in the post-Weinstein era that we live in now. So I was unhappy with that. It took a lot of liberties with fact. It's very anachronistic. For example, there's use of the expression women of colour, which I doubt very much people said in 1946. So it plays pretty fast and loose, Sean, with the actual facts on the ground that were happening in the 1940s. And I came away rather perplexed and unhappy with that, I must say.
You mentioned Jeremy Pope there, who plays the character of this writer called Archie. Now, Archie finds himself essentially, as does Jack Costello, who we met earlier, finds themselves working in a kind of gigolo capacity with both men and women in Hollywood, which is part of the seedy side that this series is getting at. But in this clip that I want to hear or listen to now, Archie hooks up with a client at a garage, a young man who goes on to be a film star called Rock Hudson. Now, the two young men seem to have made a real connection. And in this scene, Rock Hudson, played by Jake Picking, asks Archie, Jeremy Pope, to help him with a scene in a film he's auditioning for.
What are you, in a hurry?
Well, I don't make much money spending time with you.
Hold on a sec. I got an audition tomorrow. It's just one line. And I don't think I got it yet. Can I run it with you? Yeah. So Andrea McLeod, that's Barbara Stanwyck. She's trying to get in the club, but I'm the bouncer. Joe's told me specifically not to let her in.
I'm here to see Joe. The name's Andrea McLeod.
No dice, lady. Mr. Cotton ain't taking no visitors.
Ooh, okay. Maybe just throw it away a little bit more. You know?
Throw it away.
Yeah. Like, you're not angry. It's your job throwing people out. So try it more relaxed, you know? Like you're saying, kick rocks, toots. I know Mr. Cotton, and he don't like no dames like you.
That's better. I should do it like that.
Oh, no, that's your subtext. That's what you're thinking, but not saying. Okay? So think that. Relax. I'm here to see Joe. The name's Andrew McLeod.
No dice, lady. Mr. Cotton ain't taking no visitors.
That's good.
That felt good.
Yeah.
That was good. That was much better.
Can we do it again?
Archie Coleman there, played by Jeremy Pope, a young writer and clearly a good director as well, if that scene's anything to go by. He was directing Jake Picking, playing the actor who would be, or the young character who would become Rock Hudson later in the film. I said there's a seedy side to this. How seedy is it, Alan?
Well, it's as seedy as Netflix can be, I suppose, Sean. It's a fairly bawdy representation of a very bawdy time, but this is Netflix. I mean, it's a very good looking show. It's like being dropped into a candy box. But when we talk about, you know, those Hollywood orgies that did go on in the 1940s, it's very much, you know, the camera cuts away at the right moment. So this is not graphic stuff. This is a light-hearted, skittish drama, but it does have screeching tonal shifts in which the dark side, that sordid side, is portrayed. So it's a mixture of very light and very dark, and I think it succeeds in that way with contrasting that kind of Hollywood old guard, that kind of Machiavellian kind of established Hollywood, with the wide-eyed innocence. So the seediness, you're going to see a lot more seedy representations of Hollywood. Look at LA Confidential, look at Hollywood Land, Mulholland Drive, for example. This, I think, tonally and the way it looks, has a lot in common with the Coen brothers' undervalued recent movie Hail Caesar, a movie I really liked. So it kind of reminded me of that in a lot of ways, I think.
Fans of The Big Bang Theory might be surprised to see Jim Parsons here in a role that is nothing like his role in Big Bang Theory, the role of Sheldon.
Well, yeah, he plays the odious agent Henry Wilson, who was a real-life character, who was a player back in the Golden Era, who specialised in the beefcake craze in the 50s with stars like Rock Hudson and Chad Everett and Tab Hunter. Now, this character, Henry Wilson, also discovered Lana Turner. Now, Parsons, as we know, is famous as Sheldon Cooper from The Big Bang Theory, but here you see him like you've never seen him before, Sean. He plays this star-maker agent, and he likes to dress in drag as Isadora Duncan and dance around his house in the hills. He's abusive, parasitical and cruel. He's basically a monster, Sean, so maybe he's not that different from Sheldon Cooper after all, but I think he steals the show, certainly in the first three episodes of this drama.
And briefly and finally, there are numerous cameo roles here, Alan, you know, real-life characters who appear briefly and then disappear again. Did that aspect work for you?
In fact, I think, Sean, that's the best part of this programme. You know, it's cleverly done because these big stars are only bit players in a show that really concentrates on the younger wannabes. We see a flighting and damaged Vivian Leigh, fresh from her success at Gone with the Wind. We see glimpses of Hitchcock, who famously remarked that actors should be treated like cattle. Cole Porter, who basically soundtracked the whole era, pops up as a dandyish figure among the seedy moral decay. Let's misbehave indeed. And Anna May Wong, who was considered the first kind of Chinese-American actor of all time, also plays quite a considerable role in this. But Rock Hudson, I think, is the, you know, the most famous person here, and the story does, you know, evolve and revolve around him quite a lot.
Okay, that's Alan Carr speaking to us about the new Netflix series Hollywood. I think it's available from tomorrow evening, but that is our lot for tonight here on Arena. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Dunn was on sound. Tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.